This is Focus on ABC Radio Perth.
Good morning. Welcome to Monday. My name's Lucy Bell, filling in for Jess Strutt this week while she has a well-earned break. Today on Focus, we're diving into the world of parenting and the weight of expectations that come with a new baby and raising a child. Over the next hour, you're going to meet two mums who've learnt to throw out the rule book and write their own for their children. Benny Agius and Melanie Dimmitt are mums to two boys. Benny's son Richard is 28 years old and has Down syndrome, while Melanie's son Arlo is just three and has quadriplegic cerebral palsy. Both Benny and Melanie have written books about their experiences raising their boys, sharing the highs, the lows, and the lessons that they've learnt along the way. Today on Focus, you'll be hearing their stories, and I would love to hear yours too. If you have an experience raising a child with a disability, please be in touch today. It'd be great to hear the lessons that you've learnt and the best advice that you might share for other parents, grandparents, and carers in similar shoes. You can call 1300 222 720 or you can send a text 0437 922 720.
Focus on ABC Radio Perth.
Melanie, I'd love to start with you this morning. Your son Arlo is three now, and not very long after he was born, you started keeping a journal. Can you tell me a little bit about the decision to keep that journal and a little bit about some of those very early entries?
Yeah, well, I'd planned to write a book when I had a baby called The First 100 Days, sort of sharing, you know, the truths of those days when you first had a baby. I don't know why I thought that was a good idea. I'm sure it's been done before and I'm sure it's been done really well. But, you know, as I was keeping it, you know, well, we didn't have a very ordinary start with Arlo. We had an emergency cesarean because his heart rate dropped sort of just as I was about to be induced. So it wasn't a normal birth, and he got brain damage from that experience, and we would later find out that that would mean he has cerebral palsy, and then later still that that's quite severe cerebral palsy. But, you know, in the early weeks and months, we were just so certain that this wouldn't be the case. We'd been told, you know, it's a possibility, but we were just kind of doggedly in denial and no, that'll be fine. That only happens to other people. But as the days went on, you know, I was sort of noticing that he wasn't really keeping up with his peers and meeting the milestones. So that diary started getting a little bit worried and a little bit sad and a little bit desperate.
Were you honest with yourself in the diary? Like, or can you give us a sense of maybe some of the things you were writing to yourself in the diary?
Yeah, at the start I was very much, it'll be fine, it'll be fine, it'll be fine. And I mean, it helped that Arlo is such a beautiful boy. He's always been engaged and smiley and gorgeous from day dot. And, you know, I love him. I've always loved him so much. But yeah, as it went on, I was sort of asking a lot of questions like, you know, what's going on here? Could this actually be turning into, you know, our worst nightmares? Does he have a disability?
Can you take me back to the day or the time when you got that diagnosis? How old was Arlo, and can you set the scene for us a little bit?
Yeah, so Arlo was 6 months old when we officially got the diagnosis. We had been checking in with the growth clinic at the hospital prior to that, and we'd been seeing a community physio who'd sort of been hinting that we might want to check in with the Cerebral Palsy Alliance, but we would just say, no, no, that's not for us, that's not for our son. And then when Arlo was about 4 months old, the hospital asked us to record a video of him just on a white sheet for 5 minutes just to see what he did. And I remember filming him on my phone and just watching him arch over to one side and smile at his cot leg for 5 minutes straight and not do anything else. And I thought, oh, this isn't going to be good. And from that, you know, we had an appointment and sort of words like severe started to be said to us. And then we saw a pediatrician who was great. I think, you know, I've heard some shocking D-Day stories that he was very kind in giving us the diagnosis of cerebral palsy and sort of said, you know, some people only have it in one finger. You know, he would have known full well that Arlo wasn't the one finger kind of cerebral palsy, but he just said, look, this will mean you can get the funding, you can get the support you need to put him into early intervention. So yeah, he did it with a really light touch and allowed me and my partner to stay pretty in denial for some time after that even.
Mm-hmm. When you got the diagnosis, did you have, you've already sort of said that there was a little bit of denial going on.
Oh, there was plenty of denial going on, yeah.
How much did you know about cerebral palsy, or what did you understand about that as a diagnosis?
Absolutely nothing. Look, I still don't know that much about it. It's such a broad thing. It covers all sorts of movement disorders. And yeah, we'd heard the word cerebral palsy. It had been said to us in Arlo's first week in the NICU as a possibility, but I just brushed it off, didn't want to know about it. And once we did get the diagnosis, I did Google it, but I quickly learned not to, because when you put that into a search engine, it comes up with, you know, facts and statistics that you really don't want to see. So, you know, honestly, I still couldn't speak that confidently about what cerebral palsy is. Yeah.
On ABC Radio Perth, you're listening to Focus. Lucy Bell sitting in for Jess Strutt this week, and Melanie Dimmitt, a freelance journalist and mum to 3-year-old Arlo, who has cerebral palsy, is one of my guests this morning. When you spoke about that kind of the D-Day diagnosis day, can you talk about the three states that you and your partner sort of went through in the weeks that followed that?
Yeah, look, we were all over the place. We were still in denial, very much, this will be okay. If anything, this will be very mild, undetectably mild. But, you know, when you get a diagnosis, a part of you knows, you know, deep down that you can't deny this. So we were so sad. We'd just, you know, we'd keep crying on and off in those weeks. And it was a really sad time. And we were also really freaked out and scared because, you know, with your kid, you think you can follow the books, you know, it's all kind of laid out in front of you. There's a blueprint that most kids tend to follow. And when you're told that this isn't going to be how things are going, that's ripped away from you. And suddenly there's this big hole in front of you where you'd imagined a certain kind of future. And yeah, so it's frightening not knowing how things are going to play out and what your future is going to look like.
In your book, Melanie Special, you talk to parents from right around the world who are raising kids with a variety of special needs and disabilities. And I wonder how similar what you're describing here in the aftermath of this diagnosis is a sort of shared experience for people that sit in a doctor's surgery waiting to hear words that give a label to something that they're seeing and maybe don't quite understand.
Yeah, look, the experiences themselves, you know, are vastly different. Some parents knew while they were pregnant. I think that would be even more frightening because at least we had, you know, this beautiful baby in our arms when we got the diagnosis and we were starting to get to know him, and that really helped. But I think when you're pregnant, not even having your child really yet, I just think that would be even more terrifying. And some parents, you know, it happened later on, certainly with kids with autism, that tended to be around the 2 or 3 year mark. But there was definitely a shared, you know, feeling of fear. That was one that sort of everyone said they felt at the start. A lot of people asked a lot of why me. I certainly did. And, you know, there's a lot of guilt for feeling why me and for feeling scared and, you know, maybe thinking that you were in some way responsible for this happening. There's a lot of self-doubt. How on earth can I do this? And we all, you know, I think any parent deals with comparison, certainly in this day and age. And then if your child has a disability, they might not start anywhere near the same league as typically developing children. So we all, you know, would struggle with comparison quite a bit, especially at the beginning.
Yeah, and that's something we're going to talk about a lot more as the hour goes on. One thing that really stuck with me about the start of your book was an anecdote that you gave that having Arlo was a little bit like going to Holland. And I wondered if you could sort of share that anecdote with me and how you sort of use it to explain what you've experienced.
I wish that I'd made that up. That's a fantastic poem by Emily Pearl Kingsley, who has a son. I think he's in his 40s now with Down syndrome, and she's a writer. She wrote for Sesame Street for many years and has written her own book. So she wrote this poem called Welcome to Holland that I think most parents who have a child with disability will have been shown this poem in the early days. And it helped me a lot in the early days, and it was a good way of explaining to other people what we were going through. And yeah, in short, you know, you're on a plane to Italy, you've been planning to go to Italy your whole life, you've read all the guidebooks, you've learned a bit of the language, you're so excited about Italy, and suddenly just as the plane's about to land, you hear, we're landing in Holland. And you're like, what the hell, Holland? This isn't what I expected. I know nothing about Holland. I don't know the language. I don't know anything. And then, you know, over time, you know, when you sort of settle in and smell the tulips, you realize there are some really beautiful things about Holland. But, you know, all your friends have gone to Italy. They're bragging about Italy. you thought you were going there. So it is hard, and that, you know, that's something that doesn't go away. But yeah, there are so many beautiful, unexpected things about Holland. Anyway, please read the poem, because that really wasn't anything on the actual thing. And not all parents find it helpful. I certainly did. There's another one out there, Welcome to Beirut, which I think resonates more with some parents. But certainly for me, it really helped at the start to read that poem.
On ABC Radio Perth, you're listening to Focus. Lucy Bell with you this week while Jess Strutt is on holiday. And you've been hearing from freelance journalist, author and mum Melanie Dimmitt, who's been talking about the very early days following her three-year-old son Arlo's diagnosis with cerebral palsy. I'd really like to bring in Benny Aegis here as well. And Benny has also written a book about raising her son Richard, who has Down syndrome, and he's 28 now. Benny, can I ask, do you remember sort of similar thoughts, fears, feelings when you hear Melanie talk about those early weeks and months?
Oh, hello. Yes, I certainly do. And hello, Melanie.
Hi, Benny.
it is that whole thing about going to Holland, and you are so dumbstruck. But unlike a lot of parents who have children with disabilities, when you have a child with Down syndrome, the diagnosis is pretty quick. And certainly within a very short period of time, you know you have a child that is different, and you have to deal with those emotions fairly quickly. And again, although the doctors say, oh, we're going to do some blood tests just to make sure, you know, when you start thinking about people you know that have either got Down syndrome or their children have, you start looking for the signs. And so those emotions are absolutely real. You go from being in complete denial to sometimes anger to terrible sadness, and then you go through all these amazing stages of grief and then eventually acceptance. But it is a harrowing journey to start with, because you don't know. And when Richard was born, that's 28 years ago, there certainly wasn't as much available as there is now in the way of early intervention and things to actually look forward to. There was a lot of doom and gloom. And we were actually asked if we were going to put Richard in an institution very early on in the piece, which was like, so, oh my God, what? You know, and it's scary. It's because you just don't know what's ahead of you. So, yes, I certainly can totally relate to all those emotions.
Benny, you used some, I'm going to call them unconventional strategies at one point in your journey of raising Richard. Can you tell us a little bit about what you turned to?
Oh, yes. I did all those fabulous things of going to a faith healer, a psychic, Reiki. I found God again. Anything I could possibly do to make this better, I went and sought. And not only did it cost me a truckload of money, and stupidly, I believed whatever it was at the time, just to make me feel that there was some hope. And I probably shouldn't say stupidly, because, you know, whatever that hope gives you is good at the time. But on reflection, I was trying to make myself feel better, because I really felt I'd actually failed. And I think that was the big part of all this, is I wanted someone to tell me I was good at being a mum. But I did have to, I did search long and hard for the answers and the why me. But eventually it was like, you know, you just have to suck this up and get on with it and, you know, raise your son as best you can.
Benny, I believe you also at one point made a pact with God. Can you tell me about that?
Oh, yes. I was lying in the hospital bed going, okay. And, you know, by this stage I had divulged as much, taken in as much as I could about Down syndrome, which wasn't a huge amount then, because the internet wasn't so available. So it was just a lot of reading material. And I did figure out that the things that were important to me, I really wanted Richard to succeed in. So people with Down syndrome, or children with Down syndrome, often have a lot of difficulty speaking. So my pact to God went along these lines. Okay, I really want Richard to speak to me, God. I want him to be able to tell me what he feels, what he sees, what he's happy about, and what he's angry about. So I thought speech was really important. And then the second thing I wanted him to do was to read and write, because I thought, well, if he can read a train signal or a magazine, he'll be connected, so he'll be able to move around, he'll be able to get around Sydney, and he will also be able to write what he needs to write, even in the way of a gift card. I just couldn't believe that my life was going to be not even a happy birthday card. So that was really important to me too. I know these are silly little things, but they just seemed so big at the time. And then the other thing, which is probably, Richard will kill me if he hears me say this, but I really wanted him to be able to wipe his own bottom as an adult, because I thought that would be a really tough thing to do. And that, you know, that doesn't diminish what happens to a lot of people. And of course, that's, you know, I'm not being flippant about this, because there are a lot of parents that still have to do that. But for me, it was a really important thing, because I felt that that was a sign of independence, that he could be able to manage his self-care, which was really important to me. So the pact was, I would go to church more often, God, if you could make these things happen. And fortunately, we've been successful.
That idea of milestones is, I know, one that you particularly, Melanie, consider almost a dirty word, but it's something that we're going to explore a bit more for the rest of this hour. But a little bit like Benny, Melanie, you became quite obsessed with sort of one particular part of Arlo's development that you were sort of desperately wishing for as well. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, he had to walk. I just couldn't fathom a future where my son wasn't walking. It's funny, I wasn't worried about talking at the time, because we knew that the damage was in the motor section of his brain, and I didn't realize that that does affect the muscles in your mouth and your tongue. So I was like, oh no, he'll talk. He's not talking. We're working on it. But my focus was very much, he has to walk. You know, in order to be a happy, successful person in the world, you need to be walking. I feel entirely differently about that now. Like, Arlo has taught me so much. Being in the disability community has taught me so much. But I was desperate to have him walking at the beginning. I just couldn't imagine any other outcome for my child.
Any pacts with God, any Reiki, any things along those lines for you?
Gosh, no, I thought about it a lot. Just with myself, I just tell myself, this is going to be fine. He will walk, he will absolutely. I would just promise myself, but kind of deep down, you know, I was extremely scared and worried.
Mm-hmm. And Arlo, your son, is 3 now. How is he progressing in terms of, I know you've been using some really amazing technology in terms of helping him with communicating. And I know as well that you've used a strap-on. I don't know how we describe it. I'm going to let you describe it. No, that's not the right phrase at all.
Certainly hope not. No, he's in a gait trainer. So, I mean, technically he's taking independent steps in a gait trainer, which is like a little walking frame that holds him around the middle. And, you know, after many, many hours on a treadmill teaching his legs and his muscles, you know, the motion of walking, and thanks to his incredible physiotherapist who we see twice a week, he now takes steps. So in a way, he is walking. Left to his own devices, he can't roll over still. We're working on that. We're working on sitting, but he can't yet do that. And I'm not sure how that's going to go, but that's okay. You know, I'm okay with that now. I'm a lot more focused on, like you were saying, his communication. And we're using this incredible eye gaze device that follows his pupils on a screen. And he's able to make choices. At the moment, he's just playing a lot of games and saying, sing me Miss Polly over and over again. He's being a little cheeky bugger with it. But that will be how he talks and writes and, you know, goes online. And yeah, he'll take that through school with him. So, yeah, it's really exciting, you know, unlocking his mind in that way.
On ABC Radio Perth, you're listening to Focus. Lucy Bell with you this week while Jess Strutt is away on holiday. News headlines aren't too far away. And if you've just joined the conversation, today we're discussing throwing out the rule book when it comes to parenting and embracing a new normal, as it were. I'm joined by Melanie Dimmitt, a freelance journalist and mum to 3-year-old Arlo, who has cerebral palsy, and by Benny Agius, whose 28-year-old son Richard has Down syndrome. Both these mums have written books about their experiences. Melanie's is called Special and Benny's is called I'm Staying at Richard's. And your thoughts and experiences on the lessons that you've learnt parenting are very welcome. You can call 1-300-222-720 or text on 0437 922 720, which is what Kim has done. Kim says, as a person with a substantial physical disability, my parents raised me from the very beginning with love, compassion and amazing encouragement to be the best I could be. I have a career as a respected professional. My parents, who have passed, can take a lot of credit for the childhood they gave me and the life I have lived. My respect to all people caring so beautifully for children with special attributes. Thank you very much for your text, Kim. And as I say, if you'd like to join the conversation, as Kim's done, you can send through a text on 0437 922 720. We've been talking a little bit about milestones there, Melanie. You were talking about speech and walking. I imagine that with Richard now in his late 20s, Benny, there are a few different sorts of milestones that maybe you might be tempted to compare with here. I mean, I know even in my own life, I think about house ownership, work, relationships, those kind of things. How have the milestone comparisons changed for you as Richard's gotten older, Benny?
Oh, that's a really good question, actually, because the book is called I'm Staying at Richard's because I had a, I was at a meeting with a Down syndrome board meeting in the western suburbs of Sydney, and I actually lived a couple of hours away at the time. And those meetings go on forever, as they do. And one of the dads said to me, oh, goodness, you're not going home tonight, are you? You're not driving all the way home tonight. And I went, oh, no, no, absolutely not. I'm staying at Richard's. And he looked at me and I got a bit teary, and he was a dad of a little person with Down syndrome. And I said to him, I never thought I would ever say those words when Richard was little. And that's why we have the title of the book. But I think that whole idea of milestones is really important, Lucy, because we... moving into his own apartment was one of these extraordinary things that you'd never think is going to happen. And it was Richard that really pushed for this. So we've reached those early milestones at some point, not the same time as his, you know, peers, but we certainly reached them at a particular time. And that's why early intervention programs are so fantastic, in that they give you goals. And people with Down syndrome will eventually reach those milestones, but at a much later date, and some actually never do. But there's always a little hope down the line. I think the trick in all of this is, as a parent, because I'm, you know, a real high achiever, I come from families of high achievers, I wanted those milestones right there and then. And it wasn't until I kind of actually had to calm down and go, okay, we will get to those milestones. There are still some things Richard can't do, and I've had to let those things go, but he can catch a train, he can get himself about, he can take care of his washing and clothing, and his apartment is always neat and tidy. But he wanted those things to happen, and so we made sure that we put those things into place, whether they be an early intervention program from the very beginning to when he was at school, really guiding him towards an independent life. And then it became a transition to work program. He has a job that he's had for quite some time now. He has a girlfriend, which he's had for quite some time. So he's achieved quite a lot in his 28 years. And I'm so proud of him for doing that and reaching those big, you know, he's kicking big goals to get there. It's not always been easy. And sometimes we get disappointed, and sometimes we're fearful, and sometimes it's hard to let go, to let an individual with an intellectual disability get to those milestones. And I think that's a challenge for a lot of parents, to actually go, oh my goodness, okay, I'm going to let you fly. And it's hard because you don't want them to get hurt, and you don't want them to be disappointed in themselves. And actually, I didn't want to be disappointed either. But it's about getting to those places as best we can as a family with the greater community, and just ensuring that the person with, or the little person with an intellectual disability, has lots of love and lots of support and lots of care around them. So I think that's my message to a lot of young parents too, is just be patient.
Benny, I was just interested, you said there that Richard has a job. Can you tell us a little bit about what he does?
Indeed. He works at a pub in Sydney's Upper North Shore. He is the bar casual. He's permanent. He's 5 days a week. He works 5 hours a day. He collects glasses, plates. He works in the bottle shop sometimes by picking up, you know, collecting all the boxes and helping out the staff there. He's the longest serving staff member they've had, which is quite something. And it's great, you know, when he feels he needs to stretch himself. His managers feel the same. So at one stage they actually said to him, okay, Richard, you need to start answering the phone all the time. That's part of your job, which he proudly does. So it's varied. He has a lot of fun at work. The people that go to the pub regularly adore him and he adores them, and the management and staff are terrific. He's got a pretty good life, actually. Good job. Permanent.
I imagine that it's sort of that interaction as well of having friends and having structure as well.
Oh, indeed. Yeah, he gets to socialise with a lot of the younger people there, which he really enjoys. He occasionally goes on a pub crawl, which I think is really funny. Especially when he rings up next morning and says, oh, Mum, I've got a handover. It's really bad. I go, Richard, it's a hangover. No, Mum, it's a handover. It's really bad. So he does. The socialising is hugely important. I don't think people quite understand how significant it is to have a social life.
On ABC Radio Perth, you're listening to Focus, Lucy Bell with you this week. And if you've just joined the conversation today, we are discussing throwing out the rule book when it comes to parenting and embracing a new sort of normal. I'm joined by Melanie Dimmitt, freelance journalist and mum to three-year-old Arlo, who has cerebral palsy, and by Benny Agius, whose 28-year-old son Richard has Down syndrome and occasionally has a handover, we've just learnt, or a hangover after his nights out at the pub with his friends where he works. Both these mums have written books about their experiences. Melanie's is called Special and Benny's is called I'm Staying at Richard's. Melanie, in interviewing other parents of children with special needs, you learn about something called broken child syndrome. I was hoping you could explain that a little bit for us.
Yeah, so a woman called Debbie L. Nathan, who's an inventor who invented the strap-on device we were talking about earlier, where it's called the Upsy Firefly Maker, and you strap your child onto your legs and you can go around for a walk with them and they get the sensation of walking. So I was chatting with her. She's got an older son with cerebral palsy, and she was saying to me, you know, a lot of parents at the beginning see their child as broken. You know, when they look at their child, it's really hard not to focus on fixing them or seeing the thing that's different about them, or, you know, seeing them as a broken version of the child they were supposed to be, or a broken version of, you know, a typically developing child. And, you know, it's really good once you sort of move away from that thinking. And, you know, it takes time, and I think we need to be, you know, kind to ourselves at the start if that is creeping in. But once you stop seeing your child as a broken version of something else and just see them as themselves, you know, it gets a hell of a lot easier.
Mm. What would you say is your biggest hope for Arlo? Because we've been talking about this kind of weight of expectations about not being guided by milestones that are a completely different set of rules for a completely different case. What is it that you want for him?
I want him to be happy. And I completely agree with what Benny was saying about having a social life. You know, Arlo's extremely busy. He's got a lot of appointments. He's got physio, OT, three speech therapists on the go. But I think the best thing we've actually done for him has been to put him in a daycare. And it's just the little mainstream daycare up the road from us. But they've embraced him. They got all the equipment he needs. His therapists have been in there to show them what they need to do. But, you know, a lot of the time he doesn't get any special treatment there. He's loved there. He's got 20 little amazing friends there who think nothing of his disability and, you know, just have fun with him. And, you know, I just love this community that's formed around him, and even all the parents. You know, it's beautiful. Whenever Arlo hasn't been to daycare and has been in hospital, we'll return and there'll be all these cards and presents sort of stuffed into his pigeonhole. You know, there's so much love around him, and I just, you know, want to keep that going. And I think him having human connection and friends and being able to communicate and have fun, like, that's what my hope is for him. And he certainly has that now. So we've just got to keep making sure that's happening.
Mm. Can I jump in there?
Of course you can, Benny. Yeah, please.
It's so true, Melanie. Richard went into the ABC creche, actually, when I worked there many years ago at Gore Hill. And that was such a fantastic beginning for him, because it normalises and other kids don't see things that adults do. And suddenly there's a social interaction. There's, you know, learnt behaviour. And then into the same with preschools. It's just great that, you know, kids don't see the disability. They just see Arlo and Richard, and they just have fun, and they either like them or don't like them. And it's normal human interaction with all the other baggage we bring into adult life. So it's a really, that socialising is so important very early on.
I'm interested in what you both think about this idea that oftentimes when someone is expecting, and if somebody asks, oh, you know, are you going to find out the gender of the baby? And people will often return with this kind of phrase along the lines of, oh, I don't really mind if it's a boy or if it's a girl. I just would like a healthy baby. And you've both just really mentioned the importance, or that what you aspire to is happiness for your children. And I wonder if maybe we should be looking at rephrasing that into, I don't really mind whether it's a boy or a girl. What I actually want is a happy, perhaps, baby rather than a healthy baby. Does that sort of strike a chord with you at all? Yeah. I might start with you, Melanie.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's interesting. I've been listening to this fantastic podcast called Two Peas in a Podcast that has two mums who have twins. Both of them have twins with disabilities, and a bit later on, they're in their teens now, I think, and they say they hate that phrase. It sucks because it's saying, you know, I basically don't want what you got. And they think it should be, you know, I just want a kind child, like, yeah, kind and happy. I definitely think we need to change that turn of phrase. But look, I definitely said it before. And it's interesting because healthy, you know, is a relative term. A lot of the time, Arlo is healthy. We are, you know, he does get sick and we're in and out of hospital, but he's not unwell. You know, he's usually a really happy, healthy little kid. You know, he's just built a bit differently to other kids.
And Benny?
Same, actually. And funnily enough, I published a book many years ago called Lessons from My Child, which was also a compilation of people's story. And I wanted to call it As Long As It's Healthy. And my publisher talked me out of it at the time because that saying drove me insane. It was a judgment call. You know, your child isn't healthy. Your child is a disappointment. Your child is not what the rest of us wanted. And so I'd love to change that. I don't care what I have as long as it's a nice person or a kind person, as you said, Melanie, because it really does diminish our little people's capacity in the world. You know, they're suddenly just not seen as good as or as capable of. And I think that's really unfair because Richard is amazing in his kindness and lovingness and also in his crankiness. And he's just human like the rest of us. And I think that people still see that as, you know, a failure, but it's not. He's got a great life, and I'm sure Arlo's going to have a great life because it's all about what we as parents message everybody else as well, which I think is also really important. You know, we fly our flags high for our children, and I think it's really important that when we say as long as it's healthy, or, you know, we say, well, actually, I really don't mind if it's a boy or a girl as long as it's a good person or he or she is a good person.
Yeah, exactly. I think our kids really teach us that there are different ways of being in the world that are not necessarily, you know, better or worse. They're just different, and you certainly don't need to be able-bodied to be happy.
Yeah. That's right.
On ABC Radio Perth, you're listening to Focus, Lucy Bell with you this morning, and you're listening to mums Melanie Dimmitt and Benny Agius, who are talking about their sons, who are at very different stages. Benny's son, 28, who has Down syndrome, and Melanie's son, Arlo, 3, who has cerebral palsy. We've just been talking about a sort of bugbear phrase there, I suppose, where people unknowingly or unthinkingly make a comparison or make a judgment call. Did you find that you faced that and felt that a lot, Melanie, in the months after you had Arlo and were introducing him to your world and to your tribe and to people?
Yeah, look, we, you know, got that lovely stage at the beginning where you couldn't really tell that anything was up. It's interesting, Benny, I know that was probably different for you. The parents I spoke to who have children with Down syndrome said they didn't get that bit at the beginning. You know, everyone knew sort of from very early on, but we got this kind of very cushy period where I went to mother's group, I did all the things, and, you know, it wasn't really apparent that anything was going on. But then as soon as we did get the diagnosis, it's hard. People, you know, I think our family and friends were excellent. We've been very supported, but, you know, they didn't quite know what to say. There was a bit of silence. There was a bit of I'm sorry, which I can't stand. Yeah. But honestly, I don't know. I think I would have been probably a terrible friend to me on the other side of this. I wouldn't have known what to say either.
Have you come to a point now where you could maybe give advice to anybody who is listening and wants to say the right thing, or at least not the wrong thing? Maybe not the right thing, but just not the wrong thing. Do you have any advice?
Yeah, I'd say just, you know, think about what you're going to say before you say it. I had a friend, you know, who'd had a natural birth, but an extremely painful natural birth, say to me, "Oh, I'm so jealous you had a cesarean." And I was like, ooh, careful there. But, you know, I'd so rather have that conversation than not. I'd really say to friends, you know, just ask questions and also be careful, you know, with your tone of voice. One of the mums I spoke with who has a beautiful little son called Dare, who's 5 and he has Down syndrome, would say, you know, "I've got 2 other children." And when people would ask, "How's Dare?" they'd say, "Oh, how's Dare?" And with her other kids, they'd say, "Oh, so how's so-and-so?" It's like, you know, it sets it up in this really negative way from the start. So I'd say, you know, ask questions, ask us how we're doing, ask us how our kids are doing, you know, just in a, it doesn't need to be in an upbeat fashion, but just in a normal way.
Yeah. Benny, would you agree?
Oh, absolutely. You know, I actually, in my book, I've said, you know, if you come across a person, you know, a mum that's just had a baby with Down syndrome or has some issues, just still congratulate them. You know, they've had a baby. It's a blessing. Babies are beautiful regardless. And I think that's all. I get that too sometimes, even now, Melanie. "Oh, and how's Richard?"
Oh, God.
And you think, oh, for goodness sake, Richard's great. You know, don't pity him because he has a better life than most people. So I think that again, I think comes from us as parents too, where it's, I think very early on, it's really hard not to kind of go, "Oh, it's okay." But I think what's really important is to always say that this child is loved and wanted and is going to be here for a long time, and we're going to do the best as parents, as extended family, as the community, to make this little person's life as fulfilling as it can be. Pity is, I understand it because it's like, oh God, thank God it didn't happen to me. But it also sets again a tone, and I think setting that tone just makes it sad when in actual fact, that's just life now. Get on and enjoy it.
ABC Radio Perth, you're listening to Focus this morning, and we're talking about the joy of throwing out the rule book, really, and writing your own rules for raising a child with special needs. Melanie, I'm interested in how you and your partner have come together as through this experience, because obviously, as we've touched on, there are some incredible highs, but there are some real lows there as well, and it's a lot to go through as a couple, and you obviously want to provide the best, most stable, most upbeat environment for your little boy and your second child as well. How has that relationship changed for you guys over the course of the last 3 years?
Yeah, look, we've been pretty lucky. I think early parenthood is stressful anyway for couples, and throwing in a disability, and that just seems to exacerbate everything. And, you know, with a lot of parents I spoke with, their relationship did crumble, and, yeah, it's really hard. I'm lucky in that, you know, Rowan and I, we both work in the media. We've got flexible hours. We've both been able to really be there at all the appointments together. You know, Ro takes Alu to his appointments as much, if not more, than I am doing at the moment. So we've really been able to stay sort of on the same page in processing the grief around this, whereas a lot of the parents I spoke with, you know, it was the mother. You know, mums are still the primary carer, something like 95% of the time. So it was the mother who was in there, in the doctor's office, in the waiting rooms, in the therapies, and really, you know, going at this, you know, from a very different way than the dad who's at work and not in there. So that was tricky. You know, I had some mothers saying to their partners, you know, "Why aren't you more upset?" And the partners are like, "Well, one of us has to go and earn money so they can keep going to the appointments." And I think there was quite a bit of tension there of just couples not quite being on the same page with the processing. Whereas Ro and I have been so lucky. It's not like we definitely have our days, but I think if anything, this experience has made us stronger, brought us closer together.
Benny, you write in your book about raising Richard that you and Richard's dad had quite different approaches to him, and that was that could sometimes be a source of tension but also a source of support. Can you tell us about that?
Indeed. Richard's dad is fantastic, and we did split up, but that really didn't have much to do with Richard. It was just us. But he was, incredibly, I don't want to say laid back, but he was much more interested in being a good parent and just being chilled and relaxed with Richard. And again, going back to those milestones, he kept saying to me, he will get there, don't worry, he will get there. But I was just like a bull at a gate because I wanted him to be perfect. And, you know, I got myself into a whole lot of terrible mental health issues because I'm a high achiever, so my bar was really high. And I would just, you know, read up on everything, you know, drove that poor kid insane with all the early intervention goals we had to reach, you know, from picking up little tiny sultanas to hours of making bubble sounds and leg movements. So he was never given any particular rest. So I was really, I guess, manic, if you could call it anything, about getting him to do what I wanted him to do. Whereas his dad was like, we'll just go to the park and watch the birds. And I thought, oh, that's not good enough. We have to be doing stuff. So he had a kind of a good balance, I guess, because I think I probably would have exhausted him. But it does really have enormous impact on relationships. A lot of families, a lot of parents do split up. Statistically, it's quite high, probably higher than the normal, I think, if my memory serves me correctly. So it takes a lot of work because dads are often, as Melanie said, you know, they go to work, they don't see all the hard grind and they don't see all the tears and the frustration and the judgments. And they are often more chilled out than mums. And mums, you know, sometimes works as well and still has to do all those appointments being the primary caregiver. But I think what's key, if I could say anything, is really, you know, good communication is so important for relationships to survive and to talk about the hard stuff that goes on, not just the stuff we do for our children, but the stuff for ourselves, our, you know, our own deep emotions surrounding having a child with an intellectual disability is pretty tough going. And for dads particularly, because mums can at least go to mothers' groups, they can talk to their friends, which we do. Dads are a bit more isolated, and I know in the Down syndrome community they do try quite hard to, you know, have Father's Days and groups where they can sit around and chat and get together, which I think is a really excellent thing.
On 0437 922 720, Sue has texted in. She says, I have a child with a disability, 17 years old, and the disability is not visible, so we have not told anyone, and we're going to let our child tell whom they want when they're ready. Thank you so much for sending in that text, Sue. I might go back to you, Benny. Do you have some thoughts on that?
Yeah, I think it's interesting for us because we never made Richard's life about his disability. It was Richard first and then Down syndrome second. So our expectation was always that he would behave appropriately, that people wouldn't spoil him rotten, which we dreadfully, dreadfully failed at because he's terribly spoiled, but that he was not seen as a person with a disability. He was seen as Richard first. So, again, that comes from us and our philosophy as a family, and that's not just me and Richard's dad and his stepmum who have done an amazing job with Richard, but also, you know, my extended families, we've all put Richard first. He doesn't see himself as disabled. And one time I actually parked in a disabled spot completely by accident and he got really angry with me. He said, Mum, I'm not disabled. And that sets a tone for me too, in that I don't ever give him a wide berth because of his Down syndrome. It's about setting a benchmark, and he can choose sometimes to use that. It's like his little, you know, poker hand. He'll say, oh, Mum, I couldn't possibly do that because I am disabled. But most of the time he doesn't do that at all. He just gets on with life. I think that's a really great way for him to be because it sets the standard as well. He doesn't want to take the easy options, and I think that's really important. So, yeah, I think that young person that just, that mum that just texted in, I think that's a great thing to do with her daughter.
And Melanie?
Yeah, I'm just nodding my head because I'm like, yes, I so agree. We're trying very hard not to make Arlo's entire childhood about his disability, and certainly not to make his sister Odette's entire childhood about Arlo's disability. You know, you feel a hell of a lot of pressure, especially at the start, to do all of these home exercises, you know, in between Arlo's physio, OT, speech therapist, feeding specialist. There aren't enough hours in the day to do everything that we're supposed to be doing, but you feel this enormous pressure because you're told, oh, you have until they're five and then the neuroplasticity goes away, which is not correct, but you do feel an enormous amount of pressure to be constantly constantly doing these things with them. But we sort of realized, like, we don't want Arlo's entire childhood, you know, to be him propped up against a couch or practicing his 4-point kneel. And we don't want, you know, Odie being just lugged around to appointment after appointment. So we're very, you know, careful to remember that we are not therapists. We do a bit, but we also just try and have fun, you know, and go to the park, and he loves the aquarium. So we need to get back there and just, you know, give him pretty ordinary experiences as well.
Mm. On ABC Radio Perth, you're listening to Focus. Ladies, there's not as much time left as I would love to have with you both. But in wrapping up a little bit, I mean, you've obviously both, as well as having your hands very full raising these amazing children, you've both found the time to write a book about it, to sort of share your experiences and hopefully impart some lessons that might benefit somebody else, whether they're in the shoes of parent or grandparent or carer that might find themselves in similar circumstances. In wrapping up, Melanie, can you sort of explain for me what writing the book or the process of writing the book has meant for you? Because you've obviously had to carve out a lot of time to be able to achieve it along with everything else. So it obviously means a lot.
Oh, it's been crazy and I wouldn't recommend it. I'm not sure that I'd do it again. But at the time, you know, I sort of started interviewing parents when Arlo was had just turned one, and I was desperate. I was doing it for myself. I wasn't actually sure if it was going to be a book. I was just telling people I was writing a book so I could ask them the questions I needed the answers to. What did you do to feel better at the start of this? How do you feel now? Tell me this isn't what I think it is. Tell me that you're happy. I desperately needed these answers. So, you know, but as I was talking to parents, they were sort of saying similar things and common themes were arising. And I was like, oh, there might be a book here. And then, you know, I pitched it around and got a book deal a lot sooner than I was expecting, you know, when Odie was only a few months old, and then had to knock out a book, you know, in 6 months. So it was crazy, but my God, it was so healing for me, you know, to have 50 odd parents all telling me, you know, this is okay. We're all, you know, we've got great lives, or, you know, pretty ordinary lives most of the time. So it was an incredibly healing process for me and really fast-tracked me to acceptance.
And Benny, the experience of writing I'm Staying at Richard's for you?
I can't believe I've actually done this. I feel very exposed because I've really put a lot of my personal stuff in there. And when I was first approached to write the book, I went, oh, sure, that can't be that hard. And the funny thing about all this is I'm actually a publisher as well. So it's like, oh, it really is very hard writing about yourself. And I guess because Richard is 28, I had to be really careful what I was writing about him, because it suddenly occurred to me that he would read this. And so I had to be really respectful of his privacy and his dad and his stepmom, because they spent a lot of time with Richard while I, you know, did my career thing. So they raised him a lot, and people involved in his life. So I had to be really respectful of their privacy as well as, most importantly, Richard's. He has read it and loves it, and he's pulled me up on a few things that he was not happy about, which really made me laugh. I kind of went, oh, okay. So we've got to do a little bit of an edit about one thing he's particularly put out about. But it is, I think, cathartic, and it's rewarding, and it is great when people read it and say, thank you, I think that really has helped me, or you've done a great job. And it's a privilege to be able to put words on paper and for people to actually, you know, read what you have to say. So, yeah, it was great. It's good.
Ladies, thank you both so very much for coming in today and sharing your stories on Focus. Their names are Benny Agius and Melanie Dimmitt. Benny's book is called I'm Staying at Richard's. It's about her 28-year-old son, Richard, who has Down syndrome. Melanie's book is called Special. It's about her young son, Arlo, who's 3 and has quadriplegic cerebral palsy. And I think I'm right in saying that Melanie's actually launching her book tonight at Crow Books in East Vic Park at 6:30 this evening. So if you've liked what you've heard this morning, are keen to go along and pick Melanie's brain for some more wisdom, that is the place to go.
Focus on the issues that affect you on ABC Radio Perth and on the ABC Listen app.